Thank you, Cynthia, for asking me to do this morning. And thank you to all my friends and family that are here to support me today. It really means a lot to me. And thank you for all the people that don't know me, too. My topic is getting off the merry-go-round. And I know how difficult it is to come here on Sunday morning because it's not something I've done in the past either. If you can't hear me, please ask me to speak up. I forget I have a soft voice. What is the merry-go-round? You know, when I was young in the state of Minnesota, we had a state fair, and we would go to the state fair, and there would be this beautiful merry-go-round. And when you're little, and these horses are so beautiful, and they're all hand-painted, and they have all these wonderful colors and these gold columns, and you just couldn't wait to pick out the horse that I wanted or decide which one would be best. And so that's what I thought about a merry-go-round and what it was. But little did I know, there was another merry-go-round going on around in my life, and it went for many, many decades. Our own personal merry-go-rounds were created by the influence of alcoholism and other isms, that behaviors that we had in our families of origin, and that affected the way we learned how to live and how to be in the world. For most of us, if not all of us, we were affected in very, very negative and unhelpful ways. All I have to offer is my own experience, my truth of how my life spiraled out of control and caused my insanity, how my life changed and how my life is today. My father taught me that life is hard. My mom taught me that work is never done. Somehow I got the message that I don't deserve and that I wasn't important and that I didn't count. I did it wrong, all of which became a self-fulfilling prophecy. My father was a very negative workaholic. And in fact, there was very little drinking in my house. I did not know what an alcoholic was other than this character that was on the Red Skeleton Show, if you're old enough to remember that. There was a one-man skit where Red Skeleton played this character. It was a lovable drunken sot named Willie Lump Lump. And I loved to watch that program. And, he was just a wonderful, wonderful old drunk. And that's what I thought an alcoholic was. And it wasn't until much, much later in my life, I was married, that I found out that my dad's dad, my grandfather, was probably an alcoholic. And my dad even says that today. And all of my grandfather's brothers were alcoholic. And on my mom's side, my first cousin is an alcoholic. And in fact, my niece died at age 29 of the disease. And so it really was rampant in my house. And, today I understand it's rampant in all families. If it's not alcohol, it's drugs or some other isms. Like I said, in our house, it was workaholism. And I had three sons, two of which became alcoholic. My father-in-law was alcoholic as well. And one of my sons decided at age 21 that he was no longer going to drink. He went to AA and did that for a few years. And then at some point, he turned to religion, and that's where he is today. And my middle son didn't go that route. He went from beer drinking for years to getting into steroids. Steroids is the word I was looking for, in the gym. And then from there, he went into painkillers and finally ended up with OxyContin. And during this time, he lost everything except his wife. He lost his house, his money, his jobs, and he's still paying a very dear price for that today. He is not using. He is a dry drunk, and I don't think he's a very happy person. He's working at an entry-level job far, far, far underneath what he is capable of doing. But today he's finally paying the price for his own using. And he may have found that path a lot sooner if I would have allowed him to. But being a caretaker, I protected him from everything and kept him out there a lot longer than he may ever have had to do. I'll never know. But anyway, I never allowed him the dignity to be responsible for his own life. So all this is a very fertile ground for budding alcoholics and Al-Anons. And the merry-go-round began. I was one of six kids. My dad worked 10 hours a day, 5-6 days a week. He had a lot of mouths to feed. He made decent money, but we never would have known it because with six kids, it takes a lot of money to make things get together. My dad ruled the home with an iron hand, and he made all the rules, and we followed all the rules. And, you know, I don't know that, you know, we knew the, I didn't know what the rules were. I just knew there were rules. And our life was very black and white. We went to church every Sunday because he said that's what we did. And that's what we would do, and that's what we did. We never asked any questions. I am the second oldest of six kids. I'm the second daughter. And I believe I got lost in the shuffle. There was no touching in my family, not from my parents nor from my siblings. I had no sense of being an individual. I had no sense of self, no sense of being important, no sense of being loved in a special way. I was enmeshed in the brood. And enmeshment was how we lived in my life. That's how I saw it. We were tight without closeness. I felt numb. I was not in touch with feelings. I didn't know I had a right to have feelings, or that I had a right to have needs. There were no conversations that I remember with my parents that were like real conversations. They told us what to do, and that's what we did. My mom worked 24/7. And she did cleaning, baking, cooking, washing clothes, hanging them out on the line three times a week. She ironed, and she worked day in and day out. And, you know, I don't know how my mom did it. You know, when I look back at it, what a life she had, you know? And she always did what my dad told. He was the boss. We didn't, you know, like I said, we didn't have much money, but for something, my dad had this drive without schooling, that he was going to make something of himself, and he had to do that through hard work. And money became misconstrued in my family. Money became love. And I saw my dad as my God. You know, the God in my church was very powerful and non-accepting, and we were all sinners, and you know, I just learned a lot of fear. I tried very hard to please my dad. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but it was to no avail. A lot of my childhood I don't even remember. My merry-go-round is now moving and picking up speed. And ultimately, I was emotionally stuck as a young child, as a maybe 13, 14-year-old. And I stayed there for more decades than I'd like to admit. Our family was close. Our socialization was with our grandmas. who lived in a small town 60 miles south of where we lived. One pair lived in the city, which was a very small town, and the other lived about 8 miles outside of town on a farm. And that farm is where I love to go. I have happy memories of going there. Sometimes in the summer, I'd go there for a week. I'd follow my grandpa and my uncle around. I love to do that, walk out to the fields and take donut holes. And, you know, I just love to be with them. And it was a happy time, except at night. I was afraid, and I wanted to be home in that enmeshment that I knew about and where I felt safe. And it was hard for me to get to sleep at night. When I said I'd stay there for a week and my, you know, my parents' car pulled out of the farmyard, oh boy, homesickness set in already. And that's just the way I was. In the neighborhood, we played with the kids that were right on the block. There was a ton of us. Sometimes we went to the schoolyard. I was a pre-campfire girl. I can't even remember what I called myself. I don't know if that was a bluebird or not. I can't remember. But anyway, when I was in that group, somehow a friend of mine talked me into going to camp for a week. It was nothing I'd ever done. I didn't fit in with those type of girls that wanted to do all these craftsy things and were good at it and couldn't wait to get away from home and do those things. Oh, but I did it. I said I'd do it. I don't know how my parents did it, but they got the money together to send me. I went. It seemed like it was on the other side of the world. I think it was about an hour away. About 8:30 that night, the camp called my parents and said that I was very, very sick and they had to come and get me. I was so homesick. I had to go home and be where I felt safe. And let's see. So that merry-go-round kept increasing in my head. In my head, I just, you know, I just needed to be at home. As a teen, I had boyfriends. I went to school. I did my homework. I think I was a fairly good student. I worked in the summer to get clothes since I can remember. I think I was like 14 when we first started doing things. I was babysat before that. I think I was probably cute. I didn't know it at the time, but at class reunions, you know, 25 years later, guys in my class came up and told me that. never too shy to even think about that when I was in school. I can remember in high school, you know, we walked to school most of the time, and I would literally walk across the street, head hung low. If I saw anybody I knew, I mean, this would be classmates that knew me, but I was afraid that they wouldn't recognize me, even though, you know, I knew they had to know me, but I was too afraid. I just hung my head and I couldn't say hi. I didn't feel important as them. I had no sense of self-worth, and I was extremely uncomfortable with myself. I do remember one outburst of anger, and that, I don't know, I was probably 12, 13 years old. We never had a bedroom of our own. We never had a door on our bedroom. And Kathy, my older sister, and I had the same bedroom. And, you know, we used to do all this thing about being on your half of the bed and don't you cross this line. And, oh, you know, one night she just incensed me. And we had this bed with a headboard and a footboard. And the footboard was just a railing. And I was so furious that I went down to the end of that bed and did the only thing I could. I didn't do it knowingly, but I grabbed hold of that railing with my teeth and bit for all I was worth, and I hung on to that damn thing. I don't even remember, you know, what I was mad about, but that was, you know, that's all I remember about anger in myself. And I don't know. My family gets a lot of fun out of that today. most of my childhood, It was not traumatic. It felt more routine and fuzzy and hazy. I just got pretty much zoned out. And in junior high school, my brothers, which were 1 and 2 years younger than I was, my sister was like 16 months older than I was, and I was 14 months older than my brother, and my second brother was 11 months older than his brother, so that's how close we were. And, you know, my mom was popping out babies, and we were all born at home in this little town, and, you know, she just didn't have any time. So anyways, it was easy to get lost. And I was quiet. I was a good girl. I didn't cause any problems. My brothers, when they were young teens, oh, my God, they caused trouble. And you know, they acted out. I never acted out. And they got punished. I can remember my dad I was standing in the kitchen with my mother, and my dad had taken one of my brothers downstairs. He was physically hurting him. I don't remember how. But I remember I screamed in terror and ran upstairs to my bedroom and just buried myself in my pillow. And I remember that my mom came up at some point and just told me it was over. And she left the room. You know, she didn't touch me or anything. And we never talked about what happened. There were a lot of secrets in my family. They were very well kept. My parents, I didn't know it until their 50th wedding anniversary. My parents had to get married. Oh, my God. Oh, at that time, in a small town, what shame. What utter shame. I remember my dad telling me that in one of the houses that they rented, you know, my dad had this super sense of responsibility that I got, that he walked a long, long way to town. He lived in the country and work was in town. And there was this late neighbor lady that used to drive right by him and not pick him up when he was walking to town. And he assumed that, well, because he was such a, you know, did such a bad thing. So I knew we were not as good as other people. And my brother got a girl pregnant. I never knew that. I lived in that house. I couldn't believe it when my sister told me. You know, my brother died at age 48, and that son was pointed out to me at his funeral. Never saw the kid, never knew about him anything in my life. Again, I thought there was something wrong with me and that I was unlovable, and I had a horrible, horrible fear of abandonment. I became sing-songy. You know, I would sing song to myself. I would repeat songs over and over, sometimes in my head, sometimes out loud. And sometimes I just had this deep humming noise in my head that would keep me from reality. That's just how I lived in this world when I was so uncomfortable. And my merry-go-round started going faster and faster and faster. I missed my late teen years where you get out in the world and explore and find out who you are. I graduated from high school from June, and I got married in September. I gave my first paycheck, real 40-hour work paycheck, to my husband because he said that's what we should do. He said, let's get married. I perceived him as a powerful person like my dad. So I said, okay. And we got married. I did not even give myself a voice at that time. I spent my life never having made a decision. I was lost, and I didn't know I had a right to have rights. I was very responsible in the ways my parents taught me. I knew I had good, strong, solid values. We were church going. I knew how to take care of all the finances because that's what my mom did. We were ethical, honest. We wore clean clothes. We knew how to take care of our health. We know all those things. We knew right from wrong in a very, very black and white way. I learned kindness towards the elderly. I learned everybody else came first. My marriage was an absolute disaster. I didn't think. I just got into it. I began to blame myself for the unhappiness in our marriage, and I can't tell you how many times my husband said to me, "You just don't accept me for who I am." And I thought, of course I do. Of course I do. I accept you exactly for who you are. And of course he was right. I couldn't admit, even to myself, that I'd made a mistake. It wasn't okay to make mistakes in my house. When I was in school, one of my classmates asked me, I must have been engaged at that time, and she said, which is very unusual at that time that you'd be engaged in high school, and she asked me who I was marrying, and I said, Tom Karen, and she said, the only Tom Karen I know was a hood that had ducktail. That's what the hoods did in those days, and wore leather jackets. And his dad had a standard station on the corner somewhere, and I said, that's not him. And of course it was. And we were married for 12 years when my husband decided to leave. I'm going to back up just a little bit here. My husband, I found out, was anti-establishment. He got into the hippie movement, wore bell bottoms, bells, long hair, grew a beard. Totally for me, right? Straight-laced, lived in a box, and I didn't tell my family so much. Obviously, they could seize things because every one of my brothers-in-law and my husband worked for my dad, who finally got a company. My dad would call me, tell me that my husband had to get his hair cut. My husband did to the company, and just wanted to quit. He wanted to take us to Taos, New Mexico, and live in a commune. Oh, live off the land, you know. It was just going to work out swell. And here I am. Keep going, house. I got to protect these kids. This, you know, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything. And I got into depression. My world kept going spiraling out of control. I couldn't get up in the morning. I couldn't take care of my kids. They ran to school to catch a school bus. They didn't have breakfast. I was terrible. I was so totally unemotional. I was my mom. I was my mom. But what I did do is, as little money as we had, I would buy my kids a lot of things at Christmas because money was love. I was my dad. And I turned everything inward, and I wasn't outwardly angry. I got angry at myself. I learned self-hate. I blamed myself for everything. And like I said, after 12 years, my husband said, I can't stay. I can't leave. I said, I want you to leave. I want a divorce. And then after I cried rivers. I cried lakes. I cried all the time. And one day he went to work and didn't come home. And I could not believe it. I didn't want him not to go away. I just wanted him to do what my dad said men did. Take care of the family. That was his job. My dad promised me. All I had to do was take care of the house. You know, I went to the doctor. I said I was unhappy. I didn't know what was the matter with me. And he said I had shipboard sickness. I said, shipboard sickness? What's that? He said, you know, like when you're in the Navy and you're on ship for a long period of time and you can't get off. You can't get out of the house in the winter and you don't have a car and you've been inside too long. And he gave me some Valium. And I never even, I think I took one. I didn't want that stuff. My dad came over. My dad came over after my husband left that night. Whole company was in shock, I think. Since I never shared anything with my family, I think they were in shock. And my dad came over at noon on his lunch hour because, God forbid, he'd take any time off work, with a bottle of Southern Comfort because that's my husband and I drank very little of, and that's the only way my dad knew how to help me. Give me something that he knew that I liked. But we drank it very little. I think I put that under the kitchen sink. And I went deeper into depression. My mother-in-law came over to help me. I was in a fog. She got so depressed she had to leave. After 6 weeks, my husband ran to the West Bank with all the hippies and was dancing around the street, drinking pot, you know, trying drugs, baking brownies with rotten eggs like they did because everything was bought at the co-op. You know, it was just 6 weeks he'd had enough, he wanted to come home. I couldn't wait for him to come home. I couldn't wait. Well, he came home and, oh my God, it was downhill all the way. But somebody was in my house. I wasn't alone anymore. After he left, I found this note that said, there were many notes because he wrote a lot. He was a very, very bright man, very artistic. What I realized, he was really quite little, thin, but what he did is he had a beautiful use of the English language. And that's how he controlled. And that's how he got his young people to follow him. He was like kind of a Pied Piper. And that's his, people looked up to him. People looked up to him, but they didn't have to be married to him, so it was a whole different scene. So anyway, he said he was tired of being strapped to a wife that was insatiable, wanted everything her sisters had, money, 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 all the kids wanted. He was a work-a-daddy, and there was just no room for him in that world, and he had no time to pursue his creative and artistic instincts, and he couldn't do anything esoteric and, you know, read L. Ron Hubbard and all that good stuff and go to art shows and drink Sauterne, which is what they did at that time. And anyway, he came home. My dad said if I would divorce him and I wouldn't let him back in, he would give me my husband's full salary. I said, absolutely not. You know, I needed to have my husband there. I couldn't wait. My husband told me he worked and supported me for 13 years. Now I could work and support him. So I said, okay. And he lived in the basement with his dogs and worked on his jewelry. I mean, he was very good at it and didn't make any money. I went to work. I worked part-time. My eldest son came home one night. He must have been 16, because he was old enough to get a job. He was working at a pizza place. He spent his money and bought a roast for us to have for dinner. Oh my God, I will never, ever forget that. And so anyway, then my dad said I could come and work to him. So I walked through the doors of the company that my husband left with this woman from work, and her dad was still working at that company. And there I was. I didn't have any skills. And I worked in the human resources department. My brother hated that I was there, hated that all of us relatives were there. My dad owned the company, and my brothers owned the other. My dad had 51%, my brothers had equal the rest of the company. And I came in there and I said to my dad one day, you know, where do I fit in? Who am I at this company? Am I just another employee? And he said, yes. And so that was my role. I worked for my brother for 18 years. He was a son of a bitch. He was. I mean, he was not only to me, he was that to all family. He tried to take the company from my dad. He stole a lot of money from him. He was manipulative. And after 18 years, I'd finally had it. I told him I was going to quit. You couldn't have seen a more joyful person. And a few weeks later, he had already replaced me with a man that worked for me, and I walked out those doors with my tail between my legs, my head down, and nobody knew I left, but I was gone. But, oh, I have to say one other thing. Well, another thing I do when I was at work to get away from everything is I would run. At noon, even though we worked 10, 12 hours a day, I ran at noon. I ran for an hour. I would run from Northwest, where we, which was a one of those clubs where you go and exercise. I ran outside on the railroad track all the way from the club to Lake of the Isles. It was about a mile and back. And then I go back to work, and some days, most days I wouldn't eat anything, but if I did, I would eat rice crackers. You know those rice crackers that didn't have any calories? And I'd put plain yogurt on it and three raisins. And I'd eat two of those. And that's what I thought was taking good care of myself and my attempt at control. So anyway, my insanity had reached its max, and I was spinning, and then my recovery began. I went back to school. I went to college. I loved it. I was a college kid, just like the college kids. I took classes I loved. I took art history and philosophy and other kinds of history and language and all the things I loved. And it was a real growing experience for me. And I realized I did have a brain in J-term. I went to Mexico with the kids, and we learned language. And I went to China in J-term with a nun from a small college. And it was art history tour. We stayed in colleges in the dorm. It was colder than hell. And there was snow on the ground. We ate sweet potatoes from street vendors. And I absolutely adored every minute. You know, and I wasn't, so anyway, that, it was just, it was a start. And I was in therapy for many, many years. And all the while I worked, I was in therapy. And after I worked, I was in therapy. And there's a thing came along called codependency. And there was a seminar. It was three classes. And I was always trying to figure out how I was going to get well because I was sick. And I went to the seminar, and then I eventually ended up in a class for codependency. And one of the therapists said that I was the most tightly wrapped woman he'd ever met. And you know what? I was. I didn't know what that meant at that time, but I was. I was rigid, and I was black and white, and, you know, I was scared. I mean, it was horrible. So anyway, I went to this. Then I was in group therapy after that with a lot of women. And one of the women in that class, after years of being in this group, my therapist thought she couldn't do much more for me. But then she mentioned one day after I had married a second time, and my husband and I drank a lot of wine at night. We went out to dinner all the time, and he wined and dined me, and it was just so wonderful to me and got me all these things. And so, you know, I thought we were drinking a lot of wine, and I mentioned it, and she said, there's another woman in this group that belongs to AA. Would you like to try that? And I thought, of course, I'm an alcoholic. And my brother-in-law was an alcoholic. And I loved that there was a 12-step program. He had a place to go and get well. And I wanted part of that. So I went to AA, and I did that for many years. And thank God that program saved my life. It really did. And then after a period of time, I married. I think we lived in Minneapolis for 5 years. Then Jerry retired. We came to the desert. Our years together were not good in Minneapolis. I lost a house. And it wasn't through my own, well, it was because I paid money up front and the guy went broke. So anyway, Jerry thought he had to get out to California. My sister and brother-in-law already living here. My brother-in-law got him a job at a golf course, being a ranger. He had to go before I packed a thing. I had an entire house left to do myself, but he had to move cross country and get that $8 an hour job. And if he didn't get there right away, the job would be gone. Ugh. It was horrible. Nothing was going right. But anyway, I got out here, got into AA. I did that for 5 years, and then one person in AA mentioned Al-Anon. And I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I walked through the doors of Al-Anon, and I heard people saying that they learned how to do relationships. They learned how to communicate. They learned who they were. And I thought, oh, my God. I am home. I am home at last. And I fell in love with this program. I hit the ground running. I wanted to do everything. I wanted to participate. I was a secretary. I was treasurer. I wanted to do service. I got a sponsor. I got a great sponsor. I did all these wonderful, wonderful things. I was getting well. I was going to both my programs, and my husband was getting sicker and sicker, and he was angry, just like my first husband, very angry man. I didn't know it at the time with my first husband, but my second husband, he didn't drink, but he was angry. And so I told him he had to go to anger management or something, and he said he'd do it in his time, in his way. And finally it got so bad, I said, Jerry, you got to do something. And of course, I figured out a place he could go, because that's what I do. And he went to this one anger management class, and he didn't like the guy that was in charge of it, because he had such a big ego. And so I quit that. And then we started, it was just downhill in our house. We lived in the same house. We lived very different lives. I was getting weller and weller, and he was getting sicker and sicker. And finally one day I said, I got the courage. That was my first courageous thing I ever did. I said, you're out of here. And he was in total shock. He said, out of the blue, she tells me to leave. And I thought, God, didn't you get anything? And he left. And he was gone for 2 years and 3 months. And during that time, he promised he would, he wanted to come home. But he didn't want, not bad enough to do anything about it. And so finally, he said, I have to leave. I can't afford to live here anymore and have this house myself and be separated. And he was going back to Ohio because it was much cheaper to live in there, and that's where he was from. And so anyway, that was a threat. He would come over and he'd call and want to do things. He'd never done a thing to lift a hand to help while I was married to him. Now he wanted to do all these things in the house, and he would make these excuses to call and talk to me. And I said, Jerry, you need to do something. You need to get into a program. And we talked to him, my sister particularly, about Al-Anon, so he wasn't going to have anything to do with that program, you know. Nobody was telling him what to do. But anyway, at one point, he said, this is it, I got to go. I can't stay. And I said, okay, Jerry, there's one last thing. I wrote a contract, of course, I'm good at that. You go to Al-Anon for 90 days. You go to meetings two or three times a week. You get a sponsor. You work a program. Come back and we'll talk about it. And so 18 months ago, he went to Heart, and he absolutely fell in love with the program. Fell in love with it after all that time. So anyway, now we're both getting weller. And so I go to my Al-Anon meetings. I have my Al-Anon friends. I know what it is to be a friend. I know how to have a friend. I know how it is to help the next person. I know what it is to work with newcomers. I know how it is to pass the program on. And you know what? It wasn't until I could slow down enough to hear God at work in my life that I could do anything. That's when the merry-go-round stopped. I could ask God to help me and listen for what I needed to hear. And things got better and better and better. Our communication, my husband and I, is getting so good. We never had any communication before because we didn't. Neither one of us knew what communication was. We have respect for each other. We belong to groups together that teach us how to have communication with couples, which I just love. We both love. Al-Anon is first and foremost in our lives. We both have our individual programs. And you know what? The only reason that I can be here and tell you this success story today is because of my higher power and the people in these rooms. And I understand today how you people loved me until I loved myself. I learned how to love myself in a real honest and honest and caring way, because I deserved it. I deserve to be loved. And I know that you love me in a very special way, the same way that I love you, even though you won't love all of us. But in outside of these rooms, inside of these rooms, you'll love us in that very special way. And so, you know, I want to thank the program, and I want to thank you, my higher power, for leading me here. I no longer belong to Al-Anon or to AA. Al-Anon is my program, but without A&A, and I had to stay there 10 years before I got here. But it was what I needed at the time, and I did abuse alcohol, and I did belong there. My path was long and winding and long and winding and long and winding. But here I am. And on most days, the merry-go-round has stopped. And when I start to spin out of control, I have tools to work with, and I know how to use them on a daily basis. My husband and I read every morning to get in contact with God in our program. And as I began to live with the real me, I knew that I had needs and boundaries, and I set them, and I allowed myself to take care of those needs. And I have a true higher power that really loves me, and I deserve to have a really good life, and I am going to do everything within my ability to make that happen. I am going to have fun, fun, fun. And I am going to think of myself first, and I am loving me just as I am, and I am going to take very good care of me in the second half of my life, even though the second half of my life isn't going to be as long as the first half, because I'm getting too old. It's going to be so precious, and it's going to be so full of quality rather than quantity. And I accept life today based on reality. And with that, watch out, world. Here I come. Thank you.